Hi, and welcome back to the second episode in our new series of The Provider Podcast from NHS Providers. My name is Adam Brimelow, and in this series, we're looking back at some of the most talked about panels and keynote speeches from this year's NHS Providers Annual Conference and Exhibition. In today's episode, we're sharing the panel discussion from our session on NHS communications, which was called In the Eye of the Storm. The pandemic has presented extraordinary challenges for people working in trust communications. Many have found themselves working under incredible pressure and facing severe scrutiny. In this session, we reflected on some of those high-profile situations and the key role communications has played in shaping and delivering a response. On this panel, Ross Wigham, who's Deputy Director of Communications at Northumbria Healthcare NHS Foundation Trust and chairs our Communications Leads Network, is chairing the session. Our panel speakers are Michael Carden, Head of Media and Corporate Communications at Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust, Emma Castellane, Director of Communications and Engagement at University Hospitals of Leicester NHS Trust, Julie Trahan, Head of Communications and Engagement at Northwest Ambulance Service, and Dan Charlton, Director of Communications at Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. We hope you enjoy looking back on our conference and find it an interesting discussion. You can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn by simply searching NHS Providers. And to keep up to date on future episodes of the podcast, please subscribe.
Hello everyone, my name's Ross. I'm the Deputy Director of Northumbria Healthcare and also Chair of the NHS Providers Comms Lead Network. So welcome along with this online session around communications and engagement, where we'll be talking to some of the comms professionals who, as the title suggests, have been in the eye of the storm during this prolonged crisis. I just wanted to start by saying a big thanks to all our colleagues in the NHS across the country who have been working relentlessly over the past 8 months. One thing the pandemic has shown is just how important strong, effective communications can be when talking to the public, our own staff, the media, and a wide range of important stakeholders. I think NHS trusts have been challenged like never before, and we've seen communications people take a front seat role in helping their organisations cope with the pressures of a global pandemic. A new GCS report this week suggests that communications has now been elevated to a critical management priority for organisations throughout this crisis. And I've also heard anecdotally from colleagues across the country that they've never felt more part of their own organisation. I think this comes with rewards, but also increasing pressures. This session comes at a difficult time for lots of us, with large parts of the country, including where I am, in increasing local lockdowns, and the NHS collectively being asked to be ready to go again. So this is a really good opportunity to hear from some leading figures. So thank you to Michael, Emma, Julie and Dan for their time today. Each speaker is going to talk a little bit about their experiences during the crisis. So without further ado, I'd like to pass over to Michael Carden, who's going to get us started.
Thank you, Ross. Hello, everyone. My name is Michael Carden, and I'm Head of Media and Corporate Communications at Guy's and St Thomas's NHS Foundation Trust. I'd just like to start by echoing Ross's thanks to NHS providers for the important part they've played in speaking out on behalf of trusts this year, and also for hosting this session and recognising the vital role that comms teams up and down the country have played and continue to play in responding to the pandemic. Just a few words by way of context about our response at Guy's and St Thomas's before then making a couple of reflections. As a high consequence infectious disease centre, we were one of the first trusts in the country to treat people for coronavirus back at the start of the year. We sent our first all-staff email out at the end of January. We received our first patient the following week. By the end of the first wave, we'd admitted more than 1,600 COVID-19 patients, and of these, just over 330 had required critical care treatment. Our teams weren't just on the adult hospital frontline either. Our children's hospital, Evelina London, identified the rare condition in children linked to COVID-19 and treated a large proportion of these children. We run community services for two large London boroughs, and we've been leading some of the high-profile research studies in response to COVID. So as a comms team, we really do feel like we've been right through this from the very beginning. So I don't want to talk too much about the things that I know that most trusts will have been doing in response this year, important as they've obviously been. I just wanted to share thoughts on two particular points. Firstly, I think it's the importance of focusing on getting the tone of our internal communications right throughout the response. We wanted our comms to help staff feel informed, of course, but also to let them know that the trust was there for them, valued everything they were doing, whatever their role. We used every opportunity to recognise their achievements, to say thank you and highlight the contribution that everyone was making, not just the clinical teams. When we did our internal comms survey in July, as well as asking people how easy and useful our comms were to access, we also asked how did it make them feel? Did it make them feel proud, part of a team, appreciated? We've just been so conscious throughout this response of the impact that this has been having on staff, both professionally and personally, and we wanted to make sure our comms really tapped into that. The second thing I just wanted to focus on, and I think it's perhaps slightly uniquely compared to lots of other organisations, is the fact that we did have some high profile patients at Guy's and St Thomas's who've attracted significant national and international media attention. And this has obviously brought us a few challenges along the way. I'll touch on our very VIP guest in a moment, but our first experience of this was actually back in February, when there was only a handful of cases in the country, including the so-called Chalet group, who had all holidayed together in France and were patients at our trust and the Royal Free, which seems like an absolute lifetime ago. But there was inevitably a huge amount of interest in finding out who these people were, what treatment they were getting, what their isolation facilities were like, etc. And unlike many patients in the following months, they were actually largely healthy and symptomless and very aware that they were at the centre of a media storm. And we've always got a duty to protect our patients, whoever they are. And whilst the members of the group were in hospital, there wasn't a huge amount the media could do, however hard they tried. But we did need to help them as individuals and as a group to manage their situation. Some wanted to tell their story, others wanted the attention to go away. And when they left hospital, the media knew where they lived, so we worked closely with IPSO, the press standards organisation, to ensure that they could access the support in the case of press intrusion. And moving on to our next high-profile patient, the Prime Minister, who spent a week at St Thomas's in April, including a few days in critical care, as everybody knows. I'm sure it goes without saying that patient confidentiality prevents me from talking at all about his care other than the information that's already in the public domain. But I think the point absolutely stands that our comms duty of care was to our patient, and in that respect, we acted as we would with any patient, despite the phenomenal levels of media interest, both quite literally on the hospital doorstep and globally. I think just because there is more interest in somebody, that doesn't mean people are entitled to know more, whoever they are. And it probably goes without saying that it was an incredibly busy time for our team. As well as calls from the media around the world, we had to field calls from well-wishers and people wanting to suggest miracle cures. And at the same time, we had to let staff know that they were likely to see police on site with guns to remind them not to speak to the media and all of the things that come with having a high-profile patient. But our biggest challenges actually came once he left, and happened twice. First up, we had no idea he was going to put out a thank you video within hours of leaving and naming the staff who cared for him. This caused an almighty media scrum trying to find out more about the individuals involved. It was again an international issue as he focused on two nurses from Portugal and New Zealand. So our duty switched very much to protecting them as they were understandably finding the attention very difficult. And our tweet asking the media to give them privacy is actually one of our most popular ever, with more than 10,000 likes. Next time, and completely out of the blue again, was when he very kindly named his new child after the two Dr. Nicks who had cared for him, which was of course a lovely sentiment. But again, our focus was immediately on protecting the Knicks from all of the sudden media attention that they got. I think it can be very difficult to do so when the full attention of the media is on you, but while the issue or story might vary, the most important thing for us is always the individuals at the heart of it, whether they are our patients or our staff. What are their interests and how do we best protect them? So that's just a brief, but I hope useful, canter through just a few of our many experiences over the past few months at Guy's and St Thomas's.
Thank you, Michael. And the next speaker is Emma Castellan from Leicester.
Thank you, Ross, and fantastic listening to Michael there. So, like all trusts in Leicester, we were hit by the first wave of COVID with all of the communications challenges that brought with it. And we thought this was the eye of the storm for us, but we now know that we were wrong. On the 29th of June, following a couple of days of vague national and local media speculation, Leicester was quite unceremoniously put into the first ever local lockdown via an announcement from the House of Commons at 9 o'clock at night. Now, this announcement came during the same week when the rest of the country was preparing to open bars and clubs, restaurants for the first time. Other restrictions were being eased and everyone was feeling a sense of freedom and optimism. So our wonderfully diverse city of Leicester and some parts of our surrounding county were completely at odds with that national tone. And we faced a perfect storm, really. The global media and social media onslaught began almost immediately after that announcement. We had a huge volume of media inquiries to the Trust. Our partners experienced the same. Leicester lockdown was trending on Twitter. Our staff were worried and confused about what it meant for them and for their families and how they should care for patients. Racists took to social media blaming the multi-generational Asian households in Leicester for the spread. Rumour and misinformation was rife and local people were very, very angry and everybody naturally looked to the NHS for answers. So to our first thoughts as comms leads at that time, you know, it was a very strange evening, I have to say. But we thought, well, there's going to be a plan for this, right? You know, this sort of thing. There will be data that we can use to explain the decision. We'll have a map that will show us the boundaries. We can share that with the public. We'll have clear messaging, appropriate assets for us to share. There'll be a clear timeline, clear accountability for decision making. And I suspect you probably already know the answer to this, but no, we didn't have any of those things. There wasn't a plan. There were no clear messages. And the ones that we did have weren't available in other languages. They were only available in English. So we were the first area where this had happened. And to put it simply, we just had to get on with it. But thankfully, the Trust wasn't alone in facing these challenges. It's very much a partnership issue and it needed a partnership response. So what did we do? So within an hour of that announcement on that June evening, the local comms leads met virtually, joined by NHS England, and we agreed our NHS stance. It was clear we were not the leads for this, despite what the media and the public might have thought, but we did have a really clear supporting role for public health and for our local authorities. And we reached out to them that evening to agree a way forward in partnership with them. We also collectively agreed the need to use our existing community networks, the very strong NHS community networks, and the relationships we have with our local communities to amplify the public health messages that needed to be shared. We agreed joint messaging from our chief executives across the local NHS organisations and shared that with our staff to offer reassurance and guidance. We got our own data ready so that we could help manage inquiries, and we agreed our media response and lines. Now, over the course of the coming days and weeks, together with our partners, we've worked to deliver a strategy that's been focused on fast and clear communications, community level engagement, public health messaging, community cohesion, and also promoting trusted sources of information. So to give you a flavour of some of the tactics that we've used, we've prepared videos in English and 9 of the most widely spoken languages in the city. We've used GPs and trusted NHS spokespeople as talking heads to take the politics out of the messaging. We've used the same people to deliver messages via community radio stations and developed a wealth of information that's shareable on WhatsApp, which has been one of our most successful channels during the pandemic so far. We've also worked proactively with the Leicester Council of Faiths. We're briefing their leaders and encouraging them to share messages on our behalf. Together, we all took a clear zero tolerance approach to racism, which was led by the police but amplified throughout all of our channels. We also all got behind a community initiative called Together in Hope that sprung up in the days following the announcement to counter the negativity in the city. It was one of the joys, I have to say, that we've experienced during lockdown. We developed a social media strategy to tackle misinformation with quick rebuttals, and we prepared and shared clear information and guidance for our staff. We also made use of primary care and their GP SMS messaging system to deliver targeted sort of messages to local communities in specific areas. And we also rallied NHS volunteers and quite a number of NHS staff to deliver community testing and street by street messaging. And there was much, much more besides. Our strategy and tactics have served us well. We were the first, but we won't be the last, and we are still going through it. So if you've not been through a local lockdown in your area, there are some key things to think about. No two lockdowns will ever be the same. So be prepared to learn as you go and try new things. The announcement could come at any time, so do be prepared. And don't go it alone as a trust. One of the greatest strengths we've had in our response is working together as a local NHS with commissioners and providers together with a united front. Do check the quality and effectiveness of your professional networks. Don't wait to build those relationships. And do recognise the value of your local resilience forum for multi-agency working. Your community relationships and knowledge are also going to be key. So do make sure that you pay attention to those, that they're robust and that you have information available in different languages wherever possible. Also be clear on the role of the NHS. Despite what the public and the media might have thought, we aren't front and centre in this, but we do need to play our part as part of a partnership response. So we continue to face challenges here and to learn as we go. A report was published last week on the learnings from lockdown, and it did praise the efforts of local organisations in responding to the challenges. It comments on the shared commitment and the energy and enthusiasm of the people involved in the response. But it's now 100 days since the local lockdown started. Sadly, the end isn't in sight for us. We are hanging on to that community spirit that's risen from the dark days at the start. And we definitely have stronger partnerships, a shared strategy, the ability to mobilise quickly and effectively together, both within organisations and within our communities. And it really is this partnership approach that continues to be the key to us weathering the storm. Thank you.
Thanks, Emma. And the key thing for me that struck me there was the issue of partnership. And I'll move on now to Julie Trahan, who is going to talk about remote working.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'm Julie Trahan. I'm Head of Communication and Engagement at Northwest Ambulance Service. So like most, we deliver all aspects of communication together with a programme of proactive patient, public and community engagement. So we have a workforce of over 7,000 predominantly operational, disparate and mobile staff, usually offline. We've got over 109 stations, 3999 control centres, 2 dedicated 111 centres and 6 other support stores, logistics and specialist centres across the Northwest patch that we serve. So I think we had 3 main challenges during the period. The first one was to safeguard our own team whilst continuing to provide a full communication service to the Trust. The second was managing the number of key clinical and op briefings that we were being required to assist with, as well as ensuring that staff were able to confidently identify and easily access the latest information. And the third was balancing the negativity and the sheer daily challenges faced by our frontline colleagues, many of which were understandably worried about their own families, as well as those who contracted the virus. And sadly, we did, like many, lose 2 colleagues to COVID. So to give a little bit of context to the first action around safeguarding our team, we're based at our headquarters in Bolton. Now, until recently, Bolton was one of the highest infection rates, in fact, the highest rate, both the Northwest and in the country. And whilst all our team are fully enabled to work remotely, like others, we provide a 24/7 out of hours press service. Our executive team's view is that we were essential workers, in effect, providing support to our frontline colleagues. And we also needed to work closely with them, our executive team, to interpret and communicate the national, regional, and local guidance as it was being developed. So our response was to adopt a reduced and split team approach to provide an on-site presence that was compliant with social distancing requirements, but also provided resilience should one half of our team be infected. And apart from the shielding colleagues in our team, we operate a 3-day in, 2 days out, 1 week, and then vice versa to minimise contact. So the learning from this was that at times of pressure, whilst you've got 2 teams, 1 in and 1 out, you do default to those immediately around you to get things done. That's not to say colleagues working remotely weren't working as hard, but that was an issue. So we did gradually expand the 2 halves of the team working in the office as a result. Additional learning was that when people are working remotely, they often feel like they're not doing their bit to help, as well as get the more regular daily interaction with the team. We also needed to support those who were going to the office, particularly early on when national messaging was to stay home and not to travel, and obviously reaction of family and friends to people going into the office. So in relation to the second challenge around the sheer number of key clinical and operational updates we were facing and the way to enable remote, often offline staff to access that information, we decided to use our recently procured new website and intranet, which basically allowed us to implement a takeover of the homepage, which we could use to signpost to fast-changing information. Was predominantly to support us during a major incident, but obviously this technology would enable us to create a COVID-19 information hub, which we could then promote through all our channels, and staff could then confidently access everything in one place. In particular, we promoted the benefits of our staff app, which also allowed staff to access that information hub from home if needed. And we combined this with a daily summary briefing. So each of the meetings were summarised into one and published at the end of each day. Staff, as you might expect, had a lot of questions. So to support with that, we established a series of executive director Facebook live sessions, as well as a closed staff Facebook group. And the last challenge, which was in relation to the daily challenges faced by our frontline colleagues, we met that challenge by highlighting good news on our social media, in news stories, on our website, on the intranet and publications. But we also introduced a couple of new things. So we brought a Wellbeing Wednesday and a Feel Good Friday bulletin. So these were 2 weekly publications that signposted staff to sources of support, public messages, donations, NHS offers, etc. We also sent thank you cards to all our staff from our executive team. We wrote personalised letters to the children of staff, to mums, dads, grands, granddads, etc. from our chief executive. These were very popular, and staff regularly shared photographs of their children with the letters. Some even sent in short films. And then to help with our mask fit testing program, we introduced a clean shaven campaign to enlist the support of staff. We got an advocate on board, a staff beard wearer, a bit of a guru on social media in relation to beards, who filmed himself shaving it all off, talking about how important it was, together with a programme of other now beard-free staff champions. And then in our own daily team, we have a huddle, which was on Skype. We now use Teams. We do that every morning. And we assigned a welfare officer. So even if you weren't in the office, there was somebody that was checking in on you, in addition to your manager. And we did things like hosting virtual brews and other ways, basically, to keep the team spirit up. So that's what we did in relation to our challenges. I hope you found it useful.
Thank you, Julie. That's really interesting. I like the sound of Feel Good Friday bulletins. And I think as well as that, we've also really seen the importance of personal thank yous through this. And I'm sure we'll all appreciate that back in our own trusts as well. So we'll move on now to Dan Charlton, who's going to talk a little bit about the mental health pressures of the pandemic and some of the longer term impact. So over to you, Dan.
Thank you, Ross. And do you know what? My first thought when I was thinking about this session was how apt the title is, because it really does feel like we've been buffeted these last few months and blown about in all directions. So as Ross says, I'm Dan. I work for Sussex Partnership. We're a mental health trust. So I wanted to spend a few minutes just talking about this experience from the perspective of a specialist mental health trust and to highlight some of the issues that are uppermost in our minds right now as we begin to think about the next 6, 7, 8 months and beyond. First thing I'd say is that our staff have been incredible. So we've continued providing hospital care throughout COVID. We've rapidly introduced new ways of providing urgent care. And our support services have been phenomenal, working intensively to support clinical services. Going back to March, which feels like an awful long time ago now, one of our concerns from the outset was the potential impact of lockdown on increasing and exacerbating social isolation. So one of the things we did from the outset was to really ramp up our use of digital technology to support people under the care of our community services, where it became more difficult to support people face to face. And I've heard it said a number of times now that we've probably done about 3 years worth of digital adoption and digital acceleration in the last 6 months. And that's reflected in the fact we've had something like just shy of 30,000 online contacts with patients under the care of our community services since March. In terms of what we've been doing in communications at Sussex Partnership, very similar to some of the things I've already heard described, and no doubt what lots of you have been doing. Our focus, in essence, has been on staff engagement and supporting them to do their job at the same time as promoting advice and information about mental health and well-being to our staff, to our patients, their families, and the wider community. So like all of you, we've been trying to adopt to this new reality of working and engaging with staff online. We've done something like 70 webinars for staff in the last few months. We've tried to think creatively about new ways of reaching people. So we launched a new staff app and a podcast series on mental health. We've also been promoting a Learning for the Future project, which we commissioned back in April, where we've run 3 staff surveys about their experience. And we've had well over 1,000 responses to each of those surveys. So that's been looking at issues like remote working and well-being. We've worked with our psychologists to help provide and promote information about mental health through the media and through social media. And we've even made a rap about 10 ways to well-being with one of our very talented student nurses, which we're launching this Saturday on World Mental Health Day. So in summary, I really couldn't be more bowled over by the work of the comms team. I feel really proud to be part of. So where are we now? Well, worryingly, we know from the ONS that rates of depression in the community have doubled during the pandemic. In terms of our services, we're seeing much more people come into our care who are very, very unwell, often because they've lost contact with those support networks that help keep them well during quote unquote more normal times. And we know that people with mental illness have reported higher levels of symptoms during the pandemic. But importantly, this isn't an issue in terms of mental health and well-being for people who use mental health services. It really is an issue for all of us. Many of us have been deeply affected by stress, anxiety, and personal loss during this pandemic. And that really does mean, as a society and as an NHS, We do need to be braced to meet the mental health cost that the virus will exact, not just now, but in the weeks and the months ahead. For our services, that means a shift back towards more face-to-face contact with patients to try and keep people well, supported, and to avoid them reaching crisis point wherever we can. It means continuing to focus on early intervention and prevention as much as we can. It involves doing everything possible to promote advice and information about mental health and well-being. And that brings me on to the final reflection I wanted to share this afternoon, in that this pandemic has really shown once again how good the NHS communications community is in a crisis. You know, we roll our sleeves up, we're adaptable, we're creative, we keep calm most of the time, and we get on with the job at hand. But none of us can keep working indefinitely at this frenzied pace. We're not superheroes. We're all human. We're all fallible. We're all vulnerable. And we all get stressed from time to time. We all get tired. And there are times when we'll make the wrong call. So I do think as we plan ahead for this next difficult phase, it's really important we look after ourselves and look after our well-being. And the reason I say this is because it strikes me that these next 7 or 8 months, in some respects, could be even harder than the last 7 or 8 months, not least because people are tired. They've been working under sustained pressure. So we need to take care of ourselves, pay attention to basic well-being hygiene, take a break, book some leave, take that leave. And at the same time, we need to be kind to ourselves, because if we really take care to look after our well-being and the well-being of our colleagues, I do believe that will place us in the best position possible to keep supporting the work that our clinical staff do on behalf of patients. So that's the main message I wanted to share this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. I was hoping you were going to perform your rap for us there, but I think some really important messages in there. And actually, the fact that none of us can continue working at this pace, not just in communications, but right across the board, I think it's a really important one. Looking around the organisations and some of the colleagues I work with, I am seeing lots of tiredness, and it's really important, I think, that we do take time to look after ourselves. So we do have some questions, but firstly, a really big thank you to all the speakers, Michael, Emma, Julie and Dan. And before we kick off the questions, I think just for simplicity, let's go in the order that we've gone in already. The first question really is, there's a sense that things are really peaking and starting again. What feels different this time, for better or worse? And if we go to Mike first.
Thanks, Ross. I think we're probably a little bit behind the curve in London at the moment in terms of COVID, although it certainly is getting busier. But I think what's certainly different is this time around, that's combined with a whole load of other stuff. So kind of winter pressures, flu, maintaining business as usual, the big strategic work, which was all paused during the first wave, and all that's got to carry on this time. From a comms perspective, it certainly feels like it's going to be a very long, busy winter, and sort of, you know, touching on some of the stuff that Dan was saying then. I think what also feels different, though, from a COVID perspective, is that we're prepared. We've been through this once before. We kind of know what it is. We've done it once. We can and will do it again. So I think we, you know, we've got a good foundation to start from.
Thank you, Michael. Is there anything you'd add to that, Emma?
So I think Dan really touched on a lot of the points in his reflections. It's about the mental health, I think, of all of our staff, but particularly our communication staff. We tend to be very small teams. We're well supported within our organisation, but we are very small. So resilience, I think, is something that we really need to work on over the coming weeks and months, looking at sort of how we can play people in, play people out, just to make sure that we can actually continue to keep going and deliver what our organisations need us to.
Thanks. And Emma, I think you're very much in a similar situation to us in the Northeast, actually, in terms of things ramping up. So how would you respond to that one?
In terms of things ramping up here for us in Leicester, obviously, as I talked about earlier, you know, things haven't actually changed that dramatically for us. We've been in a local lockdown for 100 days tomorrow. We have started to see a rise in cases in sort of within the hospitals. And that is a worry. That is something that, you know, collectively we're all working very hard to tackle. I do think we have message fatigue out there in the community, and particularly with our staff as well. There's such a plethora of information out there, trying to really cut through that and making sure that we've got clear and concise messages that are suitable in both tone and format is really, really important to help us get through this next phase.
Thanks, Emma. And Julie, and then Dan, if I could bring both of you guys into that as well.
Thank you. I think a lot of what I would have said has already been articulated, but certainly feeling a little bit better paired. I think we've got quite a lot of information we've learned as we've gone along. I think the resilience factor is also really important. We still don't know everything. Things are changing all the time. There's always slight variances and opportunities along the way. I think for me, it's very much kind of the co-production approach, working with my team to deliver what we need to, making sure I'm testing it with them that they feel comfortable. You know, as I say, we've continued to provide the on-site presence throughout, and I'm aware that not all comms teams have done that, but that only works if you've got the support and the agreement and it's something that you've discussed with your team. So I think that co-production approach and that resilience and looking after each other is what I would say.
Thanks, Julie. And Dan?
Thanks, Ross. Yes, following on from that point, I mean, two things for me. One, I do think it's about us having serious, compassionate conversations about resilience, well-being and mental health. And part of that is about giving people permission, including ourselves, to say it's okay not to be okay all the time. There are going to be times when we'll all need to just step away and take a break. On a more positive note, I do think there's been a huge amount of learning from these last few months. It feels to me that as difficult as things have been, there's been a real focus to our decision making and a really strong sense of shared mission. So I think there's a huge amount we can build upon in order to inform our future working practices and inform patient care as we look ahead to the next 6, 7, 8 months.
And Dan, do you feel that as a system we're doing enough for people's mental health? Because I think this was an issue even before COVID, but now it's been amplified kind of almost off the charts.
I think there's always more to do. I mean, it's scary for me to think about this, but I've been working in mental health for nearly 25 years now. And it certainly feels to me that the conversation nationally about mental health and wellbeing has transformed beyond recognition during that time. And I think in terms of the NHS, we're having much more nuanced, compassionate conversations about well-being than perhaps we have done in the past. But we do really need to give it sustained attention, and we absolutely need to make sure that the psychological support is there for our staff, both now and in the future.
Thanks, Dan. And we're coming towards the end now, but one final question that's come in, slightly controversial, is that many of us were told to wait for central comms on posters and so on, and often they came a bit too late or not when we needed. What lessons does the panel have for just getting on with it versus actually amplifying that important central message? And one thing I can pick up very quickly on that is that actually in a location like the Northeast, when we're probably as far away from the centre as you can be, some of that was about our local audiences trusting the message and having our own local trusted messengers. So it was a blend of the two. While we completely appreciated the importance of having centrally controlled messaging, it was those spokespeople locally who actually do cut through with local audiences. So we've got a minute to go, I think, but I don't know if anyone wants to come in on that.
I think I'll come in on that, Ross. I mean, it speaks partly to the experience we had in Leicester. You know, an announcement like that at 9 o'clock at night without anything to actually back it up in terms of data or information that was readily available for the public really did cause a lot of issues. But I know, you know, things have changed to a certain degree. Things are being put in place, checklists, etc., to make sure that other trusts and local areas in that situation don't face the same thing. I do think you're quite right. It needs to be that blend, that balance between the messages that you do have, but also the messages you know will work with your local communities. Nobody knows our local communities better than the people who are working with them day in, day out. And I do think the partnership approach that we've used here in Leicester and that really close working with our communities is really paying dividends.
Well, it just remains to say thanks very much, Emma, and the whole panel, Michael, Emma, Julie, Dan. And I'll just end by saying a big thank you to everyone who's tuned in to listen, and also, you know, look after each other and go well. Thanks very much.